Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So, with Cabernet, as I was talking about earlier with Result, I'm not interested in blending. I want this to be 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. And I think that it's the thing that's most interesting about Napa Valley is the fact that it can produce these 100% Cabernet Sauvignon wines that are complete, complex, and ageable, that is just different from other places. Now, it could be done, I think, in other parts of the world, but not so much in Bordeaux. I want the wines to taste like Cabernet. So that means I'm probably... Well, let me back up just a little bit. I'm going to start talking about how I'm making the wine. And almost in order to be able to do that, you have to do a comparison. So I don't want people to come away thinking that I have no respect for what other people are doing and the way that they're making their wines. This is something that's really important to me because there have been other sort of mini movements that sort of give the impression that they're the only ones who know how to make great wine. And everybody else is stupid for making their wines the way they do. There are some super high-end Napa Valley Cabernets that are not in the style that I necessarily prefer, but I respect the fact that they're making them that way, and they have an amazing following of cool people who love drinking those wines. So to a certain extent, I'm just stupid for not following along with that and just making those wines as well. They're certainly capable of making that style, very ripe, really intense, sometimes... even maybe a little bit sweet, but you know, within reason, that's not even unacceptable. But that's not what I really love. And as much as I respect what these people have been able to do from a winemaking and also the business side of it, because their wines, the ones I'm referring to, and not by name, are very expensive, very, very expensive. Much more expensive than even the Secret Door wine is right now. Still, these are both a business opportunity, but also a passion project for me. So I want them to really reflect what I've learned after 30 some years in the wine business, how my tastes have changed and where I like Napa Valley Cabernets from, and other people are going to disagree. So that caveat being said, I'm picking these grapes somewhat less ripe. Not necessarily less ripe, but certainly less sugar. So there's a question mark as to ripeness, especially in Cabernet Sauvignon, because Cabernet Sauvignon, as a lot of people know, is a cross between Cabernet Franc and Sauvignon Blanc grape varieties from Bordeaux. Sauvignon Blanc really obviously has an herbal character to it. Cabernet Sauvignon, I think at its best, should have some of that reflected in the aroma and flavor profiles. And if it doesn't, then it's really not tasting much like Cabernet Sauvignon to me. So I don't want this to be like drinking vegetable water, but I definitely want it to be a wine that reflects its heritage and tastes immediately like Cabernet Sauvignon. And that, I think, really does come from picking the grapes at a particular level of ripeness that allows the rich fruit flavor that we can get in the Napa Valley to marry with this slightly herbaceous quality that is the signature of Cabernet Sauvignon. So that's what I'm shooting for. I think the 2014 that I purchased has that characteristic. I've talked to other winemakers about the level of sugar that's in the grapes that I'm picking for the 2017 and 2018 vintage, and their eyes pop out of their head and they say, "Aren't you afraid that it's going to taste really, really herbal?" And I said, "Well, it doesn't." So I'm not so worried about it when I'm tasting the wines out of barrel and they don't taste that way. They are all skeptical that this is going to work, so we'll see. If I could be completely wrong, in which case I'm going to have an awful lot of Cabernet to drink by myself, aren't I?
Well, it sounds like it started as a love letter to your wife, or at that point, wife-to-be. But what I'm hearing now, it's more like a love letter to the singularity of Cabernet.
Well, like, you know, I think it's both. I mean, okay. Of course, you start off with an idea and then, you know, you take it to the next level. Otherwise, it's simply exercise, right? You're just going through the motions to sort of say, see, I did it. And I'm not really that kind of person. So if I'm going to embrace something, then I want to do it, you know, I want to do it fully. I want it to be a real project, not just a, yeah, I promise to do this, so I have to kind of thing.
Well, I think I have a helpful suggestion for those of you that are listening. Once the wines are released, I think that people should discover for themselves, and they need to write to you and let you know exactly what they thought.
Oh, I'd love that.
And also, yeah, this whole notion of opening a door. What doors does it open in their minds?
I think that's exactly the kinds of things I was hoping for. Yeah. What challenges does it bring? After this 2014 vintage is complete, which we're in good shape with it right now. There's a little bit left, but it's going nicely. 2017 will come out this fall. So September 1, the first where it started in as grapes in my hands and went through all the way to finished wine will be released September 1st. That wine is from Stag's Leap. If you recall, one of my favorite wines, one of those sort of aha moment wines was Clos de Vaux. This is actually a vineyard that they use as well. It's called Hirondelle Vineyard, and it is literally in the beating heart of Stag's Leap. It's right next door to Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. It's right along Silverado Trail. It's a gorgeous little vineyard spot that I think is beautifully farmed, and I'm just really excited to see this wine finish and go into the bottle and see what it can do with some time in the bottle as well. But it is everything I love about Stag's Leap. And Stag's Leap is the area I really most wanted to be able to get grapes from. And was, of course, immediately rebuffed by everybody I called up at first just said, there is no grapes. You're crazy. Doug Schaefer's got them all tied up. And if anything else comes up, he'll buy those too. Which I didn't think was true. But that's one of the things I heard. And so through a friend, I found out that these grapes were in fact available and was eager to sign up for it. So I'm going to probably make about 600 or 700 cases a year of this Stag's Leap here in Del Vineyard. That will be, as I said, in September. I figured I had everything covered with that. I have a beautiful vineyard in one of my favorite parts of the Napa Valley. Right next to, you know, the sort of source of the whole name, Stag's Leap, everything I can see. And when I go to this vineyard, I can see the Stag's Leap rock outcropping. In fact, it's hard for me not to go there and take a picture of it again because it's so cool. Well, I thought I was all done. Then I got a call from another friend. She says, have you found your Cabernet yet? I said, yeah, I think I've got it. She says, well, there's another vineyard you should probably take a look at. I said, well, all right. I'm finding out now, this is a quick aside, I'm kind of finding out now that I should never go look at vineyards because it's for the equivalent of me going to see golden retriever puppies. You just can't go and not bring something home with you. So I'm trying to restrict my looking at new vineyards because of that. Regardless, I go look at this vineyard. It's way up in the hills on the east side of the Napa Valley. It used to be part of the old Pat Coletto property there. Pat Coletto sold his winery and a little bit of vineyards to Bill
Foley.
Foley, exactly. Bill Foley. But the majority of the vineyards actually got peeled off out of that deal and sold to Judy Jordan. So that's called Sage Ridge Vineyard. It is an extraordinary site way up in the mountains. It dances across this ridge top with little tiny garden-sized plots, and okay, bigger than gardens. They're an acre to 2 or 3 acres at the most. And I found one there that I just couldn't resist. It was a little over an acre, and it was planted to a unique clone of Cabernet for them. There are other Cabernet sites on Sage Ridge, but only one of them was planted to a selection of Cabernet Sauvignon that was derived from Martha's Vineyard. Mm. So that seemed really cool, different from everybody else's up there, and small enough so that I felt good about signing up for a golden retriever puppy. And I bought these grapes starting in 2017 as well. So that wine is more tannic and structured and probably needs a little bit more time before it'll be released. And so currently we have it set to come out spring of 2020.
And please tell the listeners who have been tainted by some reports of 2017 have some issues.
Yeah, that's a great question. As a matter of fact, we've just been working on the label for this wine for both the 2017s. And I put the picking dates on the back label, which is not something I would normally do. I may continue to do it, who knows, because once you start, you probably should keep doing the same thing. But I specifically put the picking dates on the back because they're well before the fire started on October 8th. So the picking date on the Stag's Leap was September 12th, and Sage Ridge was September 14th. So they were not only picked before the fires, they were fermented, pressed, and in barrel before the fires.
So let not your heart be troubled.
No, it's a great question, and you know, I'm glad you brought it up, because everybody asks me that. So when I start talking about 2017 Cabernet from the Napa Valley, it's interesting. Nobody asks me about this when it comes to Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, and there were fires over on the Sonoma side too, but not in Russian River specifically. But still, it's a big question with Napa Valley Cabernet, and so I wanted to have disclosure there so that at some point in the future, if somebody asks that question, they can look and see, well, look, at least he's claiming to have picked it before. But in fact, what you put on a label is required to be truthful. So.
Well, that, and I can't imagine you attaching your good name, that's very hard earned, to anything that doesn't have 1,000% integrity.
Well, I'm glad you think so.
Thank you for saying that. I honestly can't imagine.
I can't imagine it either. If I wasn't at this point in my career, why sacrifice it? You worked this hard to get to wherever I am, and I don't want to backtrack. So Cabernet for me is really an exciting new part, and yes, it does fulfill a promise, but it's equally exciting to do it in terms of winemaking. It's a different style, and I'm making this at a different place. So the Chardonnay and Pinot Project Maritana is made over in Santa Rosa. The Secret Door Cabernet is made in Calistoga, and I did this intentionally. I want different people working with me on these wines so that guys that are focused on know how to make Cabernet can work with me on making Cabernet. Guys that spend a lot of time doing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir can work with me on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
So let's talk about winemaking. This is, in fact, I mean, term and image is shared. It's a cool winemaking project, right?
Yeah, well, Francois is never here. He thinks I'm doing what he says, but I just do whatever. No, that's not true. No, the whole point, let's talk about Terminum and winemaking with Terminum. The whole point of this was to, since I have never made Marsan Roussan, I would have done some things differently. I've never made Syrah, I would have done some things differently. The whole point is to collaborate, to actually have a dialogue about what you want to do. And that's why I was willing to work with Francois. I don't need a new boss, but at the same time, it's fun to have a new friend. It's fun to have a new friend who has different experiences and can actually participate. He does not come here during harvest. He's kind of busy with his own harvest in France. So, but we do exchange daily, sometimes multiple times daily, texts, emails, pictures, and discuss, you know, what's going on. What does he think? And his response oftentimes is, what do you think? So it's been a blast to do this. Marsan, I'm telling you, as somebody who's been in the wine business a long time, the last thing a wine salesperson wants to hear from their boss is, hey kids, guess what? We get to sell a new Marsan Roussan this week. It is one of the most difficult things to sell because it's not Chardonnay. It's not Sauvignon Blanc. Nobody's heard of these varieties for the most part, unless you're a real wine geek. And so how does it fit into the market? What is it, you know, what's this all about? And so it's been a challenge, and we're not making a lot of it. A couple hundred cases of the Marsan Roussan, a little bit more than 120 cases of the Syrah 2017 were bottled. So we're doing very small amounts of them to kind of get started. Who knows where it'll go? I kind of figure it's always going to be small, but if people really, really love it as much as I love making it and sharing it, then we'll grow it a little bit. I'm not sure what the maximum we could do out of Alder Springs, because I want to keep buying the grapes in the same spot, but it's probably more than we're currently doing. It's all barrel fermented in neutral barrels, native yeast fermentation, surly aged. This is 100% ml, and the 2017 was bottled without filtration. You can really tell if you tip it upside down a couple of times. I'm not happy with the clarity, but still, it's not filtered. It's delicious. And what's different about this, and I don't know if any of your listeners have had Marsan from California, but sometimes they're being picked fairly ripe, like Chardonnay levels of ripeness, so 24 bricks or 24 plus bricks. And at that level, it tends to be relatively low acid, high pH, and very oily textured, almost like it's very thick and sort of heavy on the palate.
And glycerin, yeah.
Very glycerin-y and often fairly alcoholic. And so that is not the style that Francois makes in France. And we worked diligently with our buddy Stu Bewley at Alder Springs to get the grapes ripe, but not so high in sugar that they were going to end up doing the same thing. So these have come in the low 20s. So 21 bricks for Marsan is kind of amazingly low alcohol, low potential alcohol. But what it does is it continues to keep the acidity there. So the wines tend to be brighter and fresher and livelier than they would have been if you picked them at what I think a lot of winemakers would think is sort of the middle of the bell curve for white wines. Again, I'm not saying that other people are wrong in whatever they're doing. That if people like those wines, that's great. But I'm just telling you what we do, and I think that's worked really well this year, 2017. 2018 was just bottled. I think it's also really fascinating. The injection of Peak Pool Blanc has really added a lot of acidity to the wine from 2017 to 2018. Very bright and crisp, and almost like oysters, kind of like it'll go great with raw oysters kind of thing, which is tough to do with Chardonnay in California anyway, but to have a Marsan Roussan be able to do that is kind of extraordinary. So this has been fun. That part of it has really been fun, the exploring of these different vineyard sites and different grape varieties. So what does Francois want to do? It's particularly he wants to do with Syrah, whole cluster. He calls it a whole cluster. It's really more like entire stem inclusion, because he's got a particular pump he uses in France that kind of grinds up the grapes just a little bit as they go in, so they're broken and there's juice. Otherwise, you just put whole clusters into a tank, there's no juice. How do you pump it over? So the white wine has turned out really beautifully. The Syrah has just been bottled and I love this story. So Francois is telling me, as we're getting ready for 2017 harvest, he says, we tasted some older wines from Alder Springs, some older Syrahs that were very, very intense, very tannic, and really very ripe. He says, that's not the style I want to make. And I said, good, because that's not the style I want to make either. And he said, so what I want you to do is go to the winery twice a day and taste the fermenting Syrah. And I thought, it's 40 minutes each way to the winery. No, I'm not going twice a day. But I'm listening. And he says, the next thing he says, and if the wine starts to taste too tannic, I want you to stop pumping over and go bucket by bucket and sprinkle it over the top of the cap. Mm-hmm. So I figured if we are eventually going to go bucket by bucket, let's start bucket by bucket. And I went and we worked out a deal at the winery. They had the team lift this little tiny tank up, drain 5 gallons at a time out of the bottom, hand it to somebody on top, who then sprinkled it over the cap 3 times a day during the fermentation. We call this method Francois, because Francois insisted we tried it. And I'm kind of shocked at how interesting the wine is that it was derived from that, because it's much more delicate, more subtle. It's got great structure. It's turned out to be a really beautiful wine. I don't think we made this up. I'm sure somebody else has done something similar, some kind of super gentle over the top thing, but this is the first time I had ever heard of it, so I was having fun with it.
Wow. Well, certainly high tech and
not this is low tech.
At all.
This is as low as you can
I'm
get.
I'm being sarcastic.
We could have stomped the grapes with our toes. That might have been less hot.
Yeah.
No, it was fun. It was a fun, and we've continued it with 2018. We've also used that same technique. And as I said, with 2018 white, we've got a couple of different varieties that have gone in. So Terminum, Francois Villard, and Donald Patz. What a crazy team. Who would have guessed?
Well, I think it sounds like you found a great partnership.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't speak French, and his English is fairly rudimentary. So he ran into a friend of mine at the Nantucket Wine Festival, mm-hmm. like a year ago, and it was, who speaks French? And so they were talking about it, and he said, I hear that you're doing this project with Donald, and Francois' response was, yeah, I love working with Donald because he does exactly what I say.
You realize once it airs, then, you know, he could probably
find
translate
out.
It. Yeah, so you might be in trouble there.
I doubt it. No.
I feel like Maritana is a bit orphaned. We spend so much time in Terminum, and trust me, it was a really great discussion.
Maritana is the main part.
This is the real
program for me. And so the first thing people usually ask me is, you know, what does the name mean? It doesn't really mean anything other than I was trying to come up with a name that would be representative of Sonoma. So I tried a bunch of stuff. As I mentioned earlier, I tried coming up with all kinds of names, and then I'd run it through Google, and of course there was three or four people that are already trying to use that name in one way or the other. So finally I said I was going to make a name up, and so I wrote all these words down on a piece of paper about Sonoma, and then selected oceans and mountains, which probably should have been really obvious at the very beginning, but it was fun to do the exercise. Ocean became Maritime, and mountain became Montana, so it went Maritana.
Interesting.
So it is interesting, and this will be an interesting story for you, because I'm curious about if you know this, but Maritana is actually a woman's name, and there's a lot of them in Russia.
What?
Yeah, there's a lot of them in Russia. There's a amazingly horrible pop song from the very end of the Soviet era called Maritana, and I'm pretty sure somehow or another that is inspired some amorous moments that led to young children being born who were then of course named after the song. It's fascinating.
I'm not even sure what to say because I've never heard it before.
Yeah, well, it's just as well, because I'm telling you, once you hear it, you can't stop. It's stuck in your head in a bad way. But I'm sure we'll get a chance to listen to it together now that I've mentioned it.
Oh,
probably
so
not
happening.
On this broadcast.
No, we won't subject you to that. That's private time.
But anyway, I thought that was interesting. And it's also, there are some in other parts of the world too. There are some for some reason because it sounds like it might be a Latin name, right? So it could be Spanish or Portuguese. And it turns out that there's a handful of them that, and the only reason you know this is because of social media, right? I mean, why else would I have ever heard of any of these people? So social media, you click on, you put up Maritana, and suddenly there's a bunch of them. I was kind of shocked and surprised. But most of these women from wherever, whether Russia or in Brazil, there's a few, have been very interested to watch the development of Maritana as a wine. They think that's really interesting.
Yeah, but built an audience. So
kind
clever,
of built
clever
in.
Money.
I wish they were a little closer and had a lot of money. But other than that, the name was a name that I thought I created. But it's a fun name anyway. And even if it's probably rattled around in the back of my head at one day, and maybe I just made it easier to come up with it. But anyway. So the idea here was really Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and exclusively from Russian River. So where Patson Hall was interested in a wide locale from, you know, Mendocino down to Monterey, I really wanted to dial this into a smaller place and let it be from that place. Partly because I just don't have the time to drive all the way to halfway to Oregon or halfway to LA to look at grapes. But also because this is my favorite part of Sonoma. The Russian River is beautiful, and it has some of the key things that I think in order to be able to make great wine. And one is great soils. It has this crazy Gold Ridge loam soil that is really almost exclusive to the Russian River area. Very well drained. It varies quite a bit depending on where you are, from partial gravel and clay to this almost like moon dust stuff. But it's proven to be a fabulous place for growing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in that soil.
All right.
Ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so first one was soil.
Yeah.
Second one, well, climate and soil kind of together. I mean, it's a beautiful climate. The cooling influence of the Pacific really makes all the difference in this area. But the second most important thing, I think, is the grower. So, and this has multiple things. Yeah, they have to be professional and understand what it takes to grow great grapes, and also be online with the idea that in order to get the kind of grapes that we want to make the wines we want, you have to be willing to sacrifice a portion of the crop in big years in order to get the concentration of flavor that delivers the wines that we want to make. And the Russian River has that. Certainly the Duttons, the Martinellis, Charlie Chenoweth, my longtime friend, all get it. They not only get it, they have multiple people telling them the same thing. So it's not just me crying in the wilderness. It's a bunch of people saying, we need to do this in order to be able to make the wines we want. So it sets up a climate where it's much easier, I think, to get the quality that you're looking for when you don't own the land. And my goal wasn't to buy big chunks of land. I couldn't afford it anyway. But my goal was to work with the best of the best. So I've sought them out, both in Napa, but also in especially in Russian River. And we have longtime ties there. I started with the Duttons and Charlie Chenoweth in 2017 to try to find the kind of grapes I wanted. And it was a good start, but in 2018 it got even better. So we have some exciting wines. I'm interested in doing one Chardonnay that is going to be kind of a compilation of the entirety of the Russian River Valley style of Chardonnay that I'm looking for. One that is going to be kind of a Pinot that's going to be a compilation of Pinot Noir from the Russian River that I want to do. And then some single vineyard wines. And the single vineyard wines will be, you know, they have to be wines that people have some sense of where they've been in play before. I'm not interested in starting from scratch necessarily, although I have kind of a cool thing that's coming up in the distant future that will not be that way. But generally speaking, what I'm looking for are grape sources that people have heard of and understand the quality. And that helps, I think, to put a benchmark on them and understand where they're starting from. So, 2017, I made a single Pinot and I made three different Chardonnays. The Pinot and the blended, the Sonoma Russian River Valley Chardonnay both have names as well. So the Pinot is La Rousse, and the Chardonnay is La Riviere. So basically I named the Pinot Russian and the Chardonnay River, because it's from Russian River.
Very clever.
I am. Super clever. There's a reason why I did this, and that's because when this happened at Flora Springs, this happened at Girard Winery, this happened with Patson Hall. If you have just the AVA name, so if I just had Russian River Valley Chardonnay with no other name attached to it, and these single vineyard wines start coming out, well, now that wine will be the regular wine. And these are not regular wines. They're not regular. They're not like regularly priced. In other words, sort of grocery store pricing. They're expensive wines. Even the blends are expensive, and they're expensive because everything about them is going to be expensive, including the grapes and the style of winemaking. So it needs to have a designation that allows it to not be referred to as regular.
Yeah.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.